for those of you who don't know what the narrow width approximation is, it is a tool that we use for calculating scattering cross-sections. And the point is that whenever you have production of something that's heavy, even if it's unstable, you can pretend for a moment that it's an asymptotic final state and that it is stable, and treat its decay as a separate part of the calculation. It makes the entire calculation much simpler. The matrix elements are more compact, the phase space is more compact, and you don't have any other non-resonant diagrams that interfere with this. In general, that's a good thing to do. It works very well for, say, the top quark in the standard model, or for any case where the width of the particle that you produce, this resonance, is much smaller than its mass, and you're away from any thresholds. So it's very well known, for example, that if you're doing E plus E minus to W plus W minus, if you're anywhere near the W pair threshold, you have to include finite width effects. And people went through a lot of trouble figuring out how to do radiative corrections in that context. That problem was eventually solved. But you also assume that the phase space is separable, and this is an exact statement. It's really rewriting the typical Lorentz invariant phase space that you're used to for infinite state objects, and say taking two of them and splitting them off, and you're going to rewrite those as q with a d4 over q minus p1 minus p2. And you can separate that because you can do it using a trick where you have an invariant measure that divides the two different pieces. So the other two pieces that you've separated off are a separately Lorentz invariant two-body phase space. And two-body is trivial to deal with. It's just a number that's a function of the masses and two independent angles. We can all handle that quite straightforwardly. Now our calculation with regards to phase space is much simpler. To use the narrow width approximation, though, you also have to assume that the S-channel propagator of the resonance is separable. That's the thing that appears inside the matrix elements. And this is somewhat of an iffy question. The conventional wisdom says that the error that you introduce by assuming that is gamma over m for the whole calculation. And we've discovered that this is exactly not correct. Now, for those of you who have not seen this before, it's kind of useful. An integral of dq squared over the propagator squared is just this straightforward integral which you can do a change of variables on. So you're changing x, q squared and x. You have some new limits. You then say that q squared min is 0, q squared max is s, but really that's going to become minus infinity to infinity in that limit. And as long as you're not near the threshold, then you're okay on that end, and on the other end, you're pretty far away from it. People have looked at this before, how much of an error is it in saying that 0 extends to minus infinity for this Gaussian. And then that's a simple integral that you can look up, and the result is pi over m gamma. So it's a simple numerical factor. So I mentioned this one example before, and we have this empirical evidence that the narrow width approximation works really well in the context of the standard model for any kind of thing that we're going to produce. Because of that success, people have gone on to use the narrow width approximation for all kinds of beyond the standard model physics. Basically, anything that's done is done in this approximation, with perhaps just a very, very few examples for some specific cases that are quite special. Now we want to ask ourselves, where might this approximation break down? Well, number one is PDF effects. If you have some resonance, it's very massive, but it has some finite width that may be much smaller than the mass but still extends over a large region in Feynman X, then the PDFs, if they're steeply falling in X, might distort this distribution. So it could distort the shape of the bright figure. It's mostly going to be relevant for very large masses, so where you're at high Feynman X where the PDFs are steeply falling. Number two is if you have interference with non-resonant diagrams. And to have interference, you generally need a large amount of phase space to be open. That means that the width has to be a little bit larger than you might expect. But for, say, a 1 TeV object that has a couple percent of its mass expressed as a width, that could be many tens of GeV, and that could be enough phase space for interference to actually matter. So it's something that you have to check. We're going to discover that that doesn't necessarily have to be a broad width. It can happen for very narrow things as well. And then, of course, the decay matrix element. So what is the matrix element for the object that you've produced and is decaying? It depends on the particular matrix element structure, and we're going to see that it depends a lot on it. So in it, you can have convolution of the production sign and the decay sign, different topologies and different kinds of things in the final state. And it will produce different effects. And then, of course, you can have kinematic effects. This is well known, for example, if you have top quark pairs at the LHC that's a background for something else. And it's kinematically different, so you're mostly removing the top quark background with various cuts. But by doing that, you go into the off-shell region for tops. Well, the contribution there may be negligible in your mind, but If you include finite widths, it's much larger than you think. And this has been studied for LHC quite a bit before, in fact, by one of our collaborators on this group. It really matters, but we're not going to consider this because we're looking for heavy new resonances that are the signal. So this is really where something would be a background. It's not relevant for the particular case we want to look at. You should just keep it in mind. Now, as a new physics case study, I'm going to use mostly supersymmetry because it's something that most people are familiar with. There's a lot of standard phenomenology for it done. It's nice because it gives us lots of new resonances to look at. Many of them are colored. So being QCD-like, their widths can easily be a good fraction of their mass. It doesn't necessarily have to be large. I'll emphasize that again. It gives you a dark matter candidate, typically. So there's this lightest Suzy particle, which is neutral, colorless, and escapes your detector unobserved. So you have a lot of missing energy in these events. And that's going to be important for some of the things that we look at later. It's well-motivated, so it's a good model to study, favored theoretically as well as experimentally. But it's only studied in the narrow width approximation limit. No one has ever gone beyond that. There has been some bright Wigner kludging in a few cases, which I think are mostly standard model. I've been trying to get that out of the Herwig people, exactly what they do. But they're still treated as narrow width approximation-like. They don't go very far from that. So as far as we go for understanding, calculating in cross-sections and supersymmetry, we use this Madgraph package, which was performed, completed about the same time as two other packages, and it's extremely well-tested now. It's the MSSM only. It doesn't include any extra CP violation, and it doesn't care how you generated your MSSM spectrum. There's now this Suzy-Lazouchikord format for talking about MSSM spectra in a complete and totally wrapped-up language. So there's no confusion over what it is. You can calculate a spectrum using your favorite generator and give it to it, and it'll do the correct thing. It includes all spin correlations to the final state, so you're giving it the 2 to n matrix element and not just dividing the thing into pieces. You can do higher order Suzy processes, which in this case means adding additional partons. It doesn't mean doing loops. It means 2 to more than 2. And it has a consistent theoretical treatment of couplings, which turns out to be very important for electroweak parts of Suzy. I don't think we'll run into that too much here, except as a side note. It's been extremely well tested by doing all possible E plus E minus and PP or PP bar to Suzy pairs that are already in the literature. Those are checked. All possible checks of weak bosons and Higgs's externally, using unitarity as a check, electromagnetic gauge invariance checks for various things, and then this program of comparing with Sherpa and Wizard for these 435 processes. So we're very confident that actually that all three of these programs are completely correct as far as this goes. So we don't assume a Suzy breaking scheme either, so that you could do this in MSUGRA or GMSB or AMSB or your favorite, you know, pick your parameters as you want model. As long as you use this SLHA scheme, it will do everything for you, calculate all the couplings, and then give you reliable cross-sections. All right, so let's look at the first and simplest of these effects, the PDF warping effect. What I do here is consider a heavy squark scenario with a gluino that's lighter. So TeV squarks and gluinos can easily have very, very large widths. It could be multiple hundreds of GeV, but I don't go that extreme. We do know that at high Feynman X, where these things would be produced, that the PDFs are falling steeply, something like 1 over X squared or some close power of that. And so you would expect that over some significant region of X that the Breitfinger would be distorted and suppressed. What I start with is a focus point scenario that gives me heavy squarks and a lighter gluino. SPS2 is this generic snow mass points and slopes parameter useful for doing comparison studies within supersymmetry. And I see that my up and down squarks left and right are all about 1600 GeV with an 800 GeV gluino. And then the widths of these particles are over on the right hand side, so order 100 GeV for the squarks, and then of course very, very tiny for the gluino, but the gluino doesn't matter. What I care about is this gamma over this m. And in this case, this is just a few percent, order 5%, something like that. And then I construct two additional test points, one with slightly larger gluino mass, which will give me narrower widths for the decays of the squarks, and something with a slightly smaller gluino mass, which gives me wider width. So the widths here range from about 3 to 10%, or not even quite 10%, it's more like 3 to 8%. And we're going to see what this does to the cross sections. What I'm calculating is UD goes to U left, D left, where I then let the U go off shell and calculate Gluino UV left production. And actually, I interfere, you write with it, there's no interference, I just include those diagrams. And now I'm going to plot the invariant mass of the Gluino and the cork, which becomes a jet that's observed in the detector. And what I see is whether or not I decay only the U left or both together, is that on shell I have some numbers for cross sections, and off shell I have some very different numbers for cross sections. Where I've included resonant means only the resonant diagrams. I haven't included any non-resonant diagrams. And the PDFs, in fact, do warp these bright Wigners. At higher x, there's a loss compared to at lower x. And what I see is an overall sort of 10%-ish, 5 to 10%-ish loss in cross-section for these rays compared to on-shell. If I let both of the sparticles decay, it's more like order 25% for these things. So there are very large corrections that come simply from the fact that PDFs folded under the Brunt-Wigner for large width particles. And large width here means a few percent, but of a large mass is order 100 GeV, really makes a difference. It's very difficult to tell by looking at the smearing of these Breitwigner shapes that it's happened. Well, if you do look carefully, you can see that the shapes are warped slightly. However, I'll say that while this makes a point about what PDFs do to the convolution with your matrix elements, it's a little bit dodgy to not include the non-resonant diagrams when you do a QCD calculation like this. So we're going to add those in next. This is simply to make the point that PDFs do have an effect on the rate. And also, if anybody here is familiar with how SUSY studies are done in preparation for LHC, you probably know about these jet and lepton edge studies. They all assume that these particles are produced exactly on shell. And when they have their 1 to 2 body decay, there's those jets that come out of them are monoenergetic that are simply boosted in Z. That's not the case. You see that these things are actually smeared out over several hundred GeV. So that's going to have an impact on the jet and lepton edge studies. We'll come back to that again. Now let's include non-resonant interference. I'll do the same process that I had before. So these are the same two resonant diagrams that you saw. And now I'm going to add all the different diagrams that are non-resonant. That is essentially 2 to 3 gluon spork cork production. And there's a number of them that you can write. I don't try to show them here because there's a whole lot of them. The same parameters again. So this is the specialized point where I have a slightly larger width. It's like 7 or 8%. And a suppressed width, which is like 2 or 3%. Around this focus point scenario. And now I draw the resonant diagrams, Breitwigner shape, which is the solid curve that you just saw before, and the dashed curve is now adding in the piece that includes the non-resonant diagrams, which is the complete and proper way to do a QCD calculation. What you see is, for the very narrow width case, that there's some enhancement. It's mostly below the pole a little bit. It's not a whole lot. If I look over at this case here, I see, it's 50%. Looking at Breitwigner's, it's hard to tell where that is. Much of it occurs out in this tail because you're adding up a long tail. Much of it occurs close to the pole but slightly below the pole. However, in these other two cases, the total cross-section changes by anywhere from 100 to 300%. So these interferences are huge. It means that your 2-to-2 calculation is just wrong.
So if you just turned off the interference and just took the sum of all the other diagrams squared, and this on-shell diagram, but with properly integrated with the
yes.
width,
mm-hmm.
but no interference,
okay.
how much would the
I haven't bothered to do that because
so the question is how much of this 100% just simply comes from the non-resonant off-shell diagrams.
I have not tried to estimate what the non-resonant interference actually is. You can do that in a reasonable way using some other tools that we haven't done for this yet. It might be worth looking at some point. Ultimately, it doesn't matter because your detector can't see the difference between the two. All your detector can see is in some invariant mass range, what does it collect? And you don't care. I mean, you're going to give it a pole and you're going to give it another pole for the daughter particle. And then you're going to perform a QCD calculation. That's really the only proper way of doing it.
Sure, I understand.
Sure, I understand your curiosity, but I haven't done that simply to avoid the question, well, not avoid the question, but make the point to people that that's not the right way of doing the calculation. So you can't fake the right result by taking a 2-to-2 calculation and just multiplying in some K factor that you've used in, say, Herwig or Pithy or something like that. That's not going to work. The distributions are really completely different. And you can see that these distributions are radically different for these other two cases over here. Now, you might say, if I have a pole, clearly the pole is standing out there. Remember that I'm going to have two LSPs for every one of these events that I produce at the LHC. So there's two particles which escape the detector undetected. Because of that, I can't event by event reconstruct the system completely. I can't just make this invariant mass and see where the pole is. It doesn't work like that. But I could say that, what if I want to know what is the interference correction only within one or two widths of this pole? So that's what the two sigma and the one sigma means. So one particle width of that, so I'm only going to look, say, from here to here or from about here to here. What are the corrections? And I see that for the very skinny narrow case, they're 5 or 10%, which is still appreciable. But for the slightly wider case, they're still 50 to order 100%. So these are enormous corrections that are, they're actually larger than the next to leading order QCD corrections. So this is a perfect example of where doing radiative corrections was not the right thing to do first, because it's a smaller correction than doing a full off-shell calculation. It does also suggest that if you want to do this properly, you need to do a next to leading order calculation completely off-shell as well. We do have the technology to do that. People know how to handle finite widths in radiative corrections using a complex mass scheme. It's tricky and it would be a lot of work, but it could be done. People probably won't do it until the LHC actually sees something like this, and then you have to worry about it. My point, though, is the effects that you see here are many, many times gamma over n. So this old, naive approximation as to the error estimate of being gamma over m, which in this case should be anywhere from about 3 to 7%, is off by more than an order of magnitude. You're really, really off. You know, it's a factor of 30 or 40 times gamma over m. In the one sigma region, you can make an argument that it's only, you know, a factor of many gamma over m. What would happen in this case, when you see that the narrow width approximation doesn't give the same result as you get by looking at the data, even after you've done a mass measurement from a jet and lepton edge study, and even after you've measured the spin of the particle, you would think that either the coupling is different or there's something else in your sample. You simply would not extract the correct interpretation of the data because the rate is so off from this. Now let me give you an example of a case where there is almost no effect whatsoever. And this should be a U-squared left. For some reason, LaTeX has done something a little bit funny there. I have three resonant diagrams. The upper one's here. So this is a Galeno pair produced in association with a U-left score. And this Galeno I'm going to let decay to bottom-spottom. It doesn't matter if it's bottom-bottom star or anti-bottom-bottom. Spottom doesn't matter. There are two possible off-shell diagrams, one of which should make you a little bit queasy already, because this is really gluon to BD-bar splitting. So you have a collinear log singularity here that occurs in this case. If I calculate this, I discover that there's about a 5% correction using the off-shell rate. And this is done with SPS1A, so it's just some generic point with a gluino that's about 610 GeV and a spottom, which is about 530, I think. So there's a noticeable correction to the total rate, including only one decay, but it's quite small. And furthermore, it doesn't change the kinematics. So in contrast to the previous case where we saw these grossly inflated Bright Wigner shapes, we really don't see anything happen here. The Bright Wigner looks about the same. And if I plot the PT distribution for the B quark coming out, I see that all the enhancement comes at very low PT here when that log comes in. So really, this is just the collinear splitting log. To get rid of that, you normally impose a PT cut and do things without the interference. So this is a case where you don't need to worry about it. You can begin to divide things up depending on what the diagrams look like. Let me give you another example here. Actually, Bob, I think this is your version of AccuRead, because it doesn't display these problems on mine, but we're not going to worry about that. So, gluino pair production, and I'm going to let this decay. One of them goes to bottom anti-spottom, and the other one goes to B-bar spottom, so it's opposite sign cases. And there's lots and lots of diagrams. In fact, there's tens or hundreds of diagrams that interfere with this, most of which are completely off-shell, but there's a lot of single-pole diagrams where you have one gluino produced on-shell and then the bottom-spottom produced in some other method, for example, this or other that's completely off-shell. Here's another single-pole diagram, etc. There, in this case, is a significant rate correction of order 20%, which is about the same size as the residual next-to-leading order uncertainty. So it's something you would definitely want to include. It means that the next leading order uncertainty actually was an underestimate of what goes on because of off-shell effects. However, it again doesn't change the kinematics. So if I plot the bright Wigner or the PQ of the B in this case, we don't see any kind of splitting singularity here. You don't really see any change in the bright Wigner shape. And the reason for that is that the multitude of diagrams that are singly resonant interfere with the doubly resonant ones and essentially pull these two other particles into the resonance. So there's enough of those around that it just does that. The other completely off-shell ones don't dominate. So here's a case where you have a rate correction, but you don't really see some much change in the kinematics, other than the fact that this is smeared out by a bright Wigner, which your on-shell calculation does not do for you. So this, of course, will affect those jet and lepton edge studies as well. Now I'm going to do something else. I'm going to generate off-shell the same process, except this is going to be same sign decay. So each gluino goes to bottom anti-spottom. They're Majorana particles. They can do that. They can decay 50% each of the time to both of those. The complete set of QCD diagrams, however, has different structure, which it necessarily will, because you can't have diagrams like this appear in the second case. They simply don't exist because of charge conservation. So the corrections are different. In fact, the corrections are about half that size. They're only 10%. And suddenly what we have is an asymmetry between opposite sign and same sign in gluino pair production, which, if you weren't ready for it and you suddenly saw this, somebody, in fact a lot of people, are going to interpret this as some source of new physics in there, that there's a preference for why they decayed and how they did. So lots of different little things can be lurking in this data if these things were there, if you didn't calculate them properly to match to theory. So the narrow width approximation is really no good for this kind of heavy colored new physics that we get. So you should be wary of studies that have been performed with it before. There will be modifications and things will look a lot more smeared out than they previously did. Now, you can come up with dozens of examples as you want, but what I've done is shown you that there's a significant effect that comes from interference. You can get order one rate corrections, you can get much more than order one rate corrections, and significant line shape distortions. And you can find multiple cases where you find suddenly asymmetries that pop out, distinct things like charge asymmetries that you would not expect to be in the data but are suddenly there. So the LHC is about to be here. If you expect to be prepared for the LHC in discovering this kind of new physics and making any sense out of it, we're going to have to start doing more detailed calculations. And this old approximate method of doing 2-to-2 stuff like in Pythia or Hurwitz is just not going to cut it anymore, because it doesn't reproduce the physics correctly. You should be especially concerned about jet and lepton edge studies, because for the heavier the particle it is and the wider the particle that it is, the more this will be smeared out. There will no longer be sharp edges that get you very precise masses. So things that get fed into these studies like Fitino and Esfeder do, extracting the Susie-Lagrangian parameters from data, are going to have radically different pictures after you do all this. So in fact, the next step after doing this would be for us to take, for example, SPS1A or SPS3 or whichever point we choose, and simply repeat the jet and lepton edge studies that were done for that point completely off-shell and show how they look before and after. So hopefully we'll get that done by summer.
But for weak production, charging on a gluino and with good edges there, it's less of a problem?
In general, so yeah. So you have a complete... we'll get to this again later, but if... you have a cascade decay, so there's lots of things that appear in there, and there may be multiple things in there that appear that need to be done off-shell. So if you have a gluino decaying to quark skork, you probably need to treat that daughter skork off-shell as well. But when it goes to neutralino or chargino, you can probably get away with treating that as on-shell because their widths are so small. There are a very few cases where that's not true. One in particular is where you have a higgsino that comes out of this, and the higgsino can have an exceptionally large width. It could be tens of GeV in some cases. So, but those are fairly rare cases because you typically don't get much branching ratio out of them because they're heavier. Depends on the scenario you pick. But yeah, I would say that as a general rule, you can probably get away with not having to treat the electroweak stuff off-shell. Now, I'm going to show you something in the third category, which is the matrix element effect. And this is theoretically the most interesting effect. And that's an altered bright Wigner integration that comes from the actual matrix elements themselves, not from non-resonant interference. Let's categorize the decay matrix elements types depending on what kind of renormalizable vertex we have. Well, there are six of them that we can have. fermion, fermion, scalar, or vector, triple vector, 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 scalar, scalar, and triple scalar. We're going to ignore all the four-point vertices because they're essentially irrelevant as far as phenomenology goes. Whenever you have one of them, you get a point like decay. There's nothing in the daughter that's on shell, so it's heavily phase space suppressed. We'll just leave that alone for the moment. Fermion-fermion vector appears only in the MSSM weak sector. We know that observable things like vector-to-fermion-fermion decays are ruled out, like Z going to neutralinos or chargenos or something like that. However, you may have things like chargeno going to neutralino W. So, from this standpoint, you worry about what the matrix element of the chargeno does for neutralino W decays. And Max, what I should have said before is, I agree with your statement for the electroweak sector as far as interference goes. Matrix elements are going to be a different story. Fermion-fermion scalar is relevant for things like gluinos going to scorch quark or scorch going to gluino quark, depending on what the relative hierarchy in the spectrum is, if the gluino or the scorch is heavier. As far as the triple vector couplings go, there's nothing new in the MSSM. Those are standard model only. Vector-vector scalar is relevant only for the Higgs sector, and we're just going to leave that out for the moment. Vector scalar scalar, however, is relevant because you see it in things like stop goes to spotum W or spotum goes to stop W, again, depending on what the relative hierarchy in the decay chain is. That's not always an important decay in supersymmetry. It depends on what your parameter space is. There are some points where it's the dominant branching ratio and some points where it's almost negligible. Triple scalar, of course, is a trivial structure. There is no matrix element. It's just a number, one. There is no momentum dependence. There is no dot product of spinners or anything like that. However, it can have effects. And we're going to see what scalar goes to scalar, scalar, fermion, fermion, scalar, and a few of these look like in succession. And we'll start with the triple scalar, and we're actually going to step outside the context of supersymmetry for the moment and consider something in scalar field theory where I give myself this diagram where I either treat it as something off-shell or I treat it as a one-to-two process separately. You could imagine, for example, that you assigned flavor to these different scalars to allow only this one diagram. Just do it as a toy model for the moment to see what phase space does when you integrate it fully off-shell. And we want to study this analytically as well. We want to see what massless scalars do in this case. So everything here is massless except for the things that are labeled, which would be the decay, the production sign, and the resonant piece in there, which has some finite width gamma that we just fixed. And what we see is that the ratio of the off-shell to the narrow width approximation cross-section is 1 plus a correction that goes as gamma over m, but there are these factors that are betas. So this would be the beta factor for the decay, which is simply, you haven't seen the beta factor before, that would be 1 minus md squared over m squared, the standard factor. And for the production side, for m, what I mean by that is 1 minus m squared over s is the other one, so that's beta sub m. The full expression is, in fact, much more complicated than that. It's a huge mess involving lots of logs that have s, log of s dependence. But in the appropriate limits, it reduces to something like this that you can understand a little bit more qualitatively. And so you can see that as, for example, the daughter mass approaches this parent mass, you receive huge corrections to this. Or as the collision energy threshold approaches this resonance, that you get very large corrections as well. And that makes sense because as you're approaching these various thresholds, you're forcing yourself into the region where you're cutting off the bright Wigner, so finite width effects really matter. You can think of it that way, for example. Really, there are two separate limits. What I drew before is a little bit hokey. So in the limit where collision energy is much above the threshold, but the daughter mass approaches the parent mass, you see corrections that look like this 1 over beta decay squared. Whoops. I think on the previous slide, what I wrote should be beta squared instead of this here. If you write beta as the square root factor. And then where you're near threshold, but the daughter mass is much smaller than the parent mass, you get these negative corrections instead. So this plot is a little bit confusing to understand. It's actually a contour plot, where what I've written here is there is no correction on the solid line, and then successive lines to either side of that are a correction that's 1 or 3 times or 10 times gamma over m. The dashed lines over here are negative corrections, so they come from the fact where you're close to threshold, and you can see that via the left axis. As root s over m approaches this, you receive very large corrections. And the other limit is where you're well above threshold for collision energy, but then the daughter mass is approaching the parent mass. So that would be 1 minus md over m is approaching 0, and then the corrections here can become very large. This is 10 times gamma m over there. So anytime your narrow width approximation approaches any threshold, you would expect finite width effects really matter. This is nothing really new. People have understood that, and that's why, for example, e plus e minus goes to w plus w minus has to be done this way. So you can partly understand it as a phase space effect. Now what you see here is a good start for understanding what happens next. Let's go on to non-triple scalar vertex modifications. So for example, scalar, I could have the same diagrams, but scalar decays to fermion, fermion bar instead. The decay matrix element is separable because of the scalar being in there as the resonance. And so I can take that separate Dirac line and square it, sum over its helicities, and get this relation. And I see that it's proportional to q squared minus sum of the masses squared. Well, first of all, if the masses are quite large, that changes what this is, and that affects the branching ratio. But also the fact that I have the q squared dependence here changes the Breitfinger integration. And that matters in some cases. Fermion decaying to fermion scalar is in principle the same kind of thing, but now you've connected the fermion line with the initial state. So it's much more complicated to do. I'll show an example of that, but not go into any detail. Vector going to scalar-scalar, the decay matrix element is proportional to the difference of momenta of the two scalars, because that's all that's the kind of structure that you can get out of that vertex in the renormalizable theory. And that's roughly, waving my hands a little bit, proportional to q. So you have something, again, that's roughly proportional to q squared as you integrate over this Breitfinger. Scalar going to scalar vector is slightly more complicated because now the momenta difference that you're taking are one final state and q itself. But it's the same principle. These things alter your matrix elements. So let's take a look at the simplest realistic decay type in the full model, which would be something like qq bar goes to, say, spottom pairs, and now I let one of the spottoms decay to some kind of an eno and a quark. A bottom quark. If this were a blue eno, there would be one additional diagram, but we're not going to worry about that. There are also additional T-channel diagrams that could exist, but you can remove them by taking the T-channel masses, like the Skork mass there, to something very large, and they effectively decouple. There's no gauge relation between them, so I can exclude those diagrams anyway. First, again, we want to study it analytically, and we'll do that using only the resonant diagram. And we're going to assume that the bottom mass is zero, which is an excellent approximation. And we're going to fake it and assume that this anti-spottom mass is also zero to make the analytic calculation tractable. It's not correct, but it is useful for understanding the limits of what this does analytically. And we're going to use the case where the spottom actually goes to Gluino bottom, because in that case you get a larger width from it being QCD. The full result is actually several pages of Mathematica output, but if you take the leading 1 over s terms, and then match that to the leading narrow width approximation 1 over s behavior, you can get something that you can understand reasonably well. So you see some overall coefficient and then a bunch of different terms inside. I call this first one the bulk term because in the appropriate limit, this approaches 1. So it's the 1 plus corrections that you're going to see later. And then two log pieces. One of them is a log of s squared over some masses. And the other one is just a function of the decay fermion mass times a log of some of the mass differences. The coefficients are all approximately gamma over m, and you see in various places, like out front, this is the parent mass minus the daughter mass, so of course this blows up as those two approach each other, and various other things happen in there. It's ostensibly order gamma over m, except for all these different pieces on the log pieces, which were unexpected. Now, let's take two standard model limits. One is that the final state fermion mass goes to zero, and what you recover is something that looks like the ratio of the cross sections is 1/2 plus this cotangent term, which in the appropriate limit goes to pi over 2, so this becomes 1, minus something that looks like gamma over m once again, but that's probably small, and as long as s isn't ridiculously big, that's just gamma over m. So, this looks reasonable. Let's take another limit where the width is much smaller than the mass, and I can get something else, which is just reducing that down further. So it's basically what you expect. It still has this log s dependence, which people weren't counting on. But now let's rewrite this full result in a more clear form. I'm going to rewrite it in terms of these beta factors like I did before. where the beta factor for this decay case is essentially the same as this. It's one square root of 1 minus the daughter mass squared over the parent mass squared, the standard velocity factor that you would expect for a decay.
So it's not 4mf squared over ms squared?
What, where does this 4 come from?
Would the beta f be 4mf, have 4mf squared over ms squared?
Actually, no, we see it appear this way. So this is just how I define the beta. So it's close to the... the reason why that happens is when you consider a decay that goes to two identical final state fermions, you pick up a factor of 2, which becomes a 4 when you square it. But remember, I've set one of them to 0, so you don't see that here. That's where the difference comes in. So this is actually the velocity factor, but for only one fermion being massive.
This,
Right.
Yeah, okay, I see.
Okay. So this result is a little bit easier to understand when I rewrite it in terms of the betas, because you see things that look like gamma over m corrections. They may have constant terms or they may have log of s terms, but they have this beta to the minus fourth dependence out front. So this beta to the fourth is what causes these very large deviations. Now, let's see, beta to the minus x blows up for easy, that's easy to understand in supersymmetry, no problem. Let's go on. You have to be careful though, because the partial width scales as beta to the fourth itself. So modulo any other log corrections that you have, you would expect this to not really matter. That can cancel out in the cross-section ratio. So if that's the only decay that's allowed, then you don't see huge deviations. However, that's not what typically happens in supersymmetry. Typically, if you have a gluino, it can decay to many different things. It could decay to the first and second generation squarks. It can also typically decay to top stop or bottom spottom, if those are allowed. And if one of those things is not close degenerate in mass, but the other one is, then the one that is receives extremely large corrections because the width does not scale as beta to the fourth. As that other second particle's mass approaches degeneracy of the parent, the width is fixed because its partial width for that particular mode is going to zero, but the bulk is still fixed to be large. So when you have multimode decays, what we call rare branching ratios can receive huge order beta to the fourth corrections if this mass plate is small. And flip open your table of SPS points, this happens all over the place. In fact, there are many SUSY scenarios which will typically give you nearly degenerate squarks and gluinos, but then lighter spottoms or stops. So this happens all the time in supersymmetry. Effectively, what it does is gives you altered branching ratios. Now, these first results are actually done exactly with a numerical Monte Carlo, so I didn't make any approximation for the masses. And I first show you, just using fake fixed cork beams to study the behavior, what the corrections look like close to threshold and a little bit further away from threshold for single mode decays and multimode decays. So you can see that in the single mode decay case, yes, there are corrections and it can be order 10 or 20%, but they're usually not obnoxious, whereas the multimode decays, as the masses become close to degenerate, completely blow up. So those small partial widths, those rare branching ratios, receive really, really enormous corrections. The right-hand plot shows you what those corrections are in units of gamma over m. So we're talking many thousands of gamma over m corrections for those rare branching ratios. So I say that the corrections go as 10 to the x, where x is some large number bigger than 1. What do the effect of...
Could you go back to that?
Sure.
Last
we can.
So the second graph is...
This is the correction for each of these different modes in units of gamma over m. So these are the numbers of gamma over m's that you get corrected rates by.
Oh, I see.
You know, this naive idea is that off-shell effects are sort of gamma over m correction. Well, that's totally ridiculous. They're not. And you can come up with many examples that will give you that. Now, what you really care about in the end is what is the effective branching ratio. And I can define that by saying what is the real fraction of gluino pair events that will give me this rare rate compared to the bulk rate in the off-shell mode versus the narrow approximation estimate. And what we see here are the effective branching ratio in blue for two different cases. This one is very close to threshold. This one is a few factors above threshold. And the red curve is the effective branching ratio enhancement by whatever factor it is. And you see that when you're very close to threshold, threshold type effects dominate. You don't have a lot of room for doing this. So while up here in the rare branching ratio mode, you may be down to a percent or two or something, you see factors of a couple correction, you may not care. However, something that's much closer to what actually happens at the LHC is that you're not exactly at threshold all the time. You're usually a bit above it. This is a bit more accurate what it'll actually look like once you put PDFs in there. You see that even when the mass degeneracy is only 5% or even 10%, you get very large corrections. And within the 5% mass degeneracy range, which is really not all that close, you can get order 10 corrections to the effective branching ratio. So, suppose you turn the LHC on, and you fire it up, and you start to see Suzy production of particles. And you may have gluino pairs, which most of the time go to Scorks, the first and second generation, but you have this very taggable rate going to bottom-spottom. So you can tag those Bs and those events and pick those out separately. Based on the masses that you measure using, say, a jet and lepton edge method, you may think that the spottom mass should be such and such, and therefore its branching ratio, knowing all the QCD couplings, should be 5%, and suddenly it's 15%. Or it should be 1%, and suddenly it's 10. You have these order 10 corrections, or order multiple corrections to effective branching ratios. When you feed this data back into SFETR and FATINA, which are now including things like ratios of branching ratios in their schemes, you're going to make a completely wrong interpretation of what the Suzy parameter space is. You will not extract the Lagrangian parameters correctly. So you must include these off-shell effects with complete matrix elements, including the decay, to correctly reproduce the physics. And I can go on and on. I could give you an infinite number of examples that will do this. The same thing occurs if I do, say, stop pairs, and stops go to W spottom. Now, you have to be a little bit more careful about this, and it's much harder to analyze analytically because there are actually three different diagrams, and these are gauge-related. So I cannot exclude two of them to make it simpler and just do one of these. But we see essentially similar effects. You get huge corrections to effective branching ratios, and you get overall shifts of, you know, a few tens of percent to the rate, even in the single-mode decays. Now, this is actually the process that we started with because it's the simplest to understand. There are only two possible diagrams that you can construct that will give you an off-shell gluino going to something, and they're independent. You can take these two diagrams to be completely separate if you want. It's Chargino gluino production, and I'm going to let the gluino decay to a different flavor than the initial state. There are no non-resonant diagrams possible. If I set the bottom quark mass and the Chargino mass to zero, or effectively let this be long-lived, which can happen in supersymmetry, I can analyze this system completely. This is, however, a different matrix element. In this case, I have a fermion line that's connecting the initial state d-bar quark all the way to the final state d-bar quark. Or, in the other case, slightly differently, would be via the U, and the Majorana matrix can change that direct structure, but still the initial and final state are connected. So there is some dot product that screws things up slightly differently. Now, what we see in this case is a result that looks qualitatively similar to the equation that you saw before, except that in one of these logs is this mt to the fourth. Mt, in this case, is the mass of the T-channel particle. So we see that the interference also involves other structures in the production side. So the decay and the production are really not separable in this way. And of course, the exact corrections that you get are dependent on the exact mechanism that you have. So if you have a slightly different topology, it will be slightly different. I can still take the same standard model limits in this case. They look like order gamma over m with log s corrections. So they will resolve to what I would expect. Except, once we write these things in a clearer form using these beta factors once again, it's beta s because the parent is now a fermion and the daughter is an s, you get beta to the minus fourth enhancements to the gamma over m rates. And then depending on whether or not it's a single possible mode decay or a multi-mode decay, then one of those different things can be enhanced drastically. Now let's go back to this for a second, too. Something else that we discovered fairly recently in this is that there is a helicity selection effect. So if I switch into a slightly different process, I do either, say, gluino going to U left, U quark, or U right, U quark, then the fact that I have helicity selected the initial state to be left because of this Chargino influences the relative rate of U left U versus U right U coming out. And they're no longer equal. They can differ by a couple tens of percent. So Gluino decays no longer even respect left-right, the same as they do anymore. Now, you would say that, of course, at the LHC, that something like Chargino-Gluino production is too small a rate to ever worry about. But you get the exact same thing by doing production of, say, U goes to U left score. And now I have a T-channel of Gluino going to a final state. So here this could be U left or U right score. And this is going to be U bar quark, and this is going to be a gluon initial state. So the fact that this I have a chirality handed score produced in association with a gluino influences what that gluino will decay to. It will preferentially choose it by some small factor to be a left-handed score rather than a right-handed score, which is also unknown, which means that if you start producing gluinos in association like this, that you get end up getting more left-handed ones, which give you Charginos in the final state, as opposed to quark LSP, which comes from the right-handed guys. So again, you've introduced yourself suddenly another charge asymmetry, and you don't know where it came from. So these helicity selection effects are also important at a smaller level, but still order 10% or so, which for an asymmetry is a glaring asymmetry. So let's just discuss for the moment a few technical issues. Number one is, what about gauge invariance? A finite width technically breaks it since it mixes orders in perturbation theory. You have to be careful about how you introduce it. In general, it's okay to get away with it. We can check that in our cases explicitly by setting the width to zero in the matrix elements and multiplying by the propagator factor outside, the right figure squared, as a correction factor. So for all the test cases that we look at where we know that there's no... where we don't know that there is definitely a gauge issue, we can get away with this and check it. So, for example, the graphs that I just showed you. So what we're doing is not an effect of breaking gauge invariance and making a mistake in the calculation. It is a true effect. You might also ask yourself, what about logarithmic alpha s running, because we're seeing things that correct according to log of s. Does that compensate the log s dependence in the matrix element? And the answer is no. They are truly two independent, separate things. And you can test that if you want, by calculating alpha s of the q squared of the scale of the problem. That would be the invariant mass of the resonance that you're producing, whatever off-shellness that it has, point by point. And you can see that the log behavior is diminished slightly because alpha s grows, but the log running of alpha s is different. There's a completely different matrix element structure than what you're producing with these diagrams. And so you're left with this overall cross-section dependence that would grow as log s over s. So Breitfinger integration and alpha s running are orthogonal different things. In higher order in perturbation theory, there might be some effect of the two interfering with each other, but they are still independent things, and this behavior will persist. And then the third thing, if you're awake and you've paid attention to stuff over the years, you'll know that you wonder about unitarity, because there's this, it was hammered into your head as a graduate student that cross-sections decrease as 1 over s at most, as s increases, or they decrease faster than that. So are we violating unitarity by this? And the answer is no. The Froissart bound, which is the proper way of summing up over all partial waves of calculating the unitarity limit, actually produces an additional log squared that comes from the summing over partial waves. So we're actually quite far from the proper unitarity limit whenever we do this. You can check it numerically, you're orders of magnitude away from it, so there's no problem with this at all.
Question there. Didn't you have some log s's that had a beta something to the minus 4?
You're still always very, very far away. No. What happens is that you can correct the branching ratio by 10 to some obscene number, but the total rate will never get corrected by that number.
That's because there's an overall phase to the plus 4.
Essentially, you can think of it that way. The partial width for that minor mode decays as beta to the fourth as well. So you can correct the relative rate between the two, but the overall total rate to all possible final states never violates this bound, which is the important thing. So what happens at two levels of decay? Because obviously in SUSE you can get chains out of squarks and gluinos that would decay to successively lighter and lighter things all the way down to some LSP, the dark matter candidate. In fact, you see this happen in little Higgs theories as well. If they have a T parity added, you get cascading decays. You also see it in extra dimensions models where you have a lightest Kaluza line particle, and if there's a parity, then it becomes stable. It's your dark matter candidate. In fact, people have made a minor industry out of faking SUSY signatures with extra-dimensional models like UED models. You get very qualitatively similar cascade decays, and you'll get exactly the same kind of physics there. Case for case, the matrix elements will be slightly different because the interferences will be different, and the decay matrix element will be fermion scalar versus scalar fermion, etc. But the same principle happens in all cases. The three big questions we need to ask are, number one, does the matrix element effect depend on the intermediate resonance or the final state masses? Because ultimately you could say that the final state masses are close to zero. Number two, does a daughter Bright-Wigner introduce its own effect? And number three, do resonant and non-resonant diagrams interfere? How far down the decay chain do I have to worry about doing this off-shelf stuff? Because if I have, say, four successive levels of decay in this chain, then that's an awful lot of Feynman diagrams that I might be generating at the end of the day. That could become obscenely complicated to integrate reliably in a finite amount of time. First one, two levels of decay. First, examine this thing that we did before. So it's UD bar going to Chargino Gluino. Gluino goes to bottom spottom. Spottom goes to neutralino B. Now, of course, I can have a spottom 2 in there, but I could make it more massive. Doesn't matter. I can essentially decouple that. We don't have an analytical form for this, and I don't know that we'll ever be able to make one. It's pretty complicated already at one level. However, using fixed energy beams, numerically we find that the matrix element enhancements from the first decay are still present. So let's say that I made this neutralino essentially massless. I don't see a change. So it's really the pole that matters. It's the existence of that pole daughter close to the parent pole that affects this. However, you can get a super enhancement. So for a daughter particle very close in mass to the parent, then there is an additional enhancement which comes from the following physics. The daughter particle, being scorched, is also going to have some appreciable width. Now it may only be a few GeV or 10 GeV or something like that, but it's going to be appreciable. Now this is going to be, say, the invariant mass. And so somewhere around here I have the gluino pole. And the spottom pole is somewhere below it. And now I've got to draw a Bright-Wigner around it as well. And in fact, those two Bright-Wigner never really overlap significantly. They still stay many widths away from each other as you move these masses closer together. But remember that the correction to these, this decay matrix element goes as beta to the fourth. That means that when I allow this spottom to go off shell, it spends some of its time a little bit above that, and some of its time a little bit below that. But beta to the fourth is an extremely strong dependence. So I have to move only a little bit above this pole, which that Bright-Wigner allows me to do, and that beta to the fourth factor becomes dramatically more effective. It gives you much more enhancement. So allowing this daughter particle to go off shell can enhance the first level of decay's effect essentially through this phase space, because so much of the time it will spend closer to the pole, and therefore that beta to the fourth factor matters more. If of course the poles are very far separated, then it's not going to matter, but you don't have much of an effect there to begin with. So this gives you a bit of a guide over when you don't have to bother thinking of the next particle in the decay chain off shell either. If there's enough mass separation, this effect isn't going to matter, then you don't worry about it. Or if the width is so incredibly small because it's electroweak, for example, then it wouldn't matter either. But in cases like this, at least, gluino's going to scorks or scorks going to gluino's, you're probably going to always have to do both of them completely off shell. Now let's take another case. This is the gluino going to top stop, and now I let the stop go to I misspoke. This is going through the spottom still, but now the spottom goes to W stop. There could be a second spottom resonance, or there could be this off-shell diagram where top goes to WB and there's a stop produced on the other side from the gluino. Again, I can effectively decouple the second spottom by saying its mass is much larger. I'm not going to worry about that. There are two important observations here. One is that the interference of the three diagrams is present, and it can be at the few percent level, so it really does matter in some cases. You have to carefully consider what the different diagrams are when you do this kind of interference, and if they are going to interfere significantly. But number two, the subsequent W decay doesn't matter. So it appears that you can always get away with, at some level, chopping off the off-shellness and not worrying about it anymore. And that should pretty much clear up all those remaining details. Particle widths in many new physics scenarios are large, so even a naive order gamma over m correction is important. But what I just showed you is that there are many cases where these sources of off-shell effects, whether they come from the matrix elements in the Bright-Wigner integration, or they come from an open amount of phase space in QCD interference, can be many, many times gamma over m. So you can't simply do an on-shell calculation and say, well, gamma m is 5%, which is large for a particle, but I don't care. 5% smaller than what I'm going to measure. It could actually end up being 50% or much more than that. You can get very dramatic enhancements to the effective branching ratios. And things that should be super rare modes are not so rare anymore, complicating extraction of parameters. You can also get non-resonant interference that's order 1 corrections, much larger than your QCD corrections. And those are not straightforwardly predictable. I gave you an example where the corrections are huge and an example where the corrections are essentially non-existent. So in many cases, you simply have to try them and see what they're like. Off-shell effects are not specific to supersymmetry either. They're going to occur exactly the same way in UED models where you're trying to mimic SUSY, or little Higgs models where you have a chain of these things as well. They simply are not studied as much because people haven't spent as much time with those models. And you get a lot of... you can easily introduce a lot of asymmetries, like charge asymmetries from these off-shell effects. And people would, if they saw charge asymmetries, would immediately start claiming things like CP violation. So be very wary of what you see in any new physics data until you've done complete calculations. So the next steps, what we have in this program plan, is to do QCD interference for heavy gluino instead of heavy squark, because you'll see much larger effects. The gluinos will have typically much larger widths. In fact, when you typically see these LHC gluino discovery plots, they go up to about 2 TeV. Well, a 2 TeV gluino can easily have a width that's of order its mass. So you need to be a little bit careful about how you think of these particles up there. But those discovery contours are extremely misleading because they pretend that you've produced an on-shell particle with 2 TeV, which clearly is not at all realistic. It's going to be significantly below that. Between PDF and interference warping, you're going to see a dramatic reduction of where that pole mass looks like it sits. You can get same sign versus opposite sign asymmetries, and we want to see how this affects these background subtracted discoveries. So there's some standard SUSY analyses that take gluino pairs, which are a background to something else. You measure the opposite sign rate and use that to subtract the same sign rate from something else that you've done, or did I say it backwards? I've forgotten which. In any case, you use it to look for a particular SUSY signal by removing some of the other SUSY background. If you don't understand the off-shell effects and you didn't understand that the asymmetry is there, you do the wrong background subtraction and now your secondary signal that you dug out is completely screwed up. The practical results for LHC for these three different vertex types in the mass scan cause effective changes in the branching ratios. That's going to be the most important thing. And the SUSY parameter space that you extract from that will be the most important result that you get from that. We're going to attempt to find a better rule of thumb for success of decays. For now, if it's QCD, like if it's a colored object, you're going to have to do an off-shell. Things after that depends a little bit on what it's decaying to specifically. There are cases like the top going to bottom, W, etc., where you have to worry about gauge invariance and so on, but sometimes you can get away without that. And then finally, what the impact on a jet and lepton edge study is, I think that's probably what people are going to want to see first, because it's going to be the most dramatic change to existing LHC phenomenology. All right, I think that's it. Jack, or Jack first?
Go ahead, Jack.
Okay. Well, again, it would be nice if you checked in the same sign versus opposite sign whether or not interference really is important. Actually, I did some games like this back in the SSC days and found that under certain circumstances, at any rate, there wasn't a big interference. I mean, it's certainly true you have to include the background diagrams, but then that business of compensating subtractions and what have you would work in that case.
I think actually we just showed that it is all interference in that case, because it's if you look at the kinematic distributions of like the Bright-Wigners or the PTs of these things, they don't look any different, which means it's really that the doubly resonant diagrams are pulling the singly resonant diagrams on shell. It's making them mimic that phase space. I can check it explicitly by just removing the double pole pieces. But I'm pretty convinced that that's what's going on.
I think it would be good to do that.
Okay.
Let's say I have two questions. So I guess the first one is a question maybe you should be asking me instead of the other way around. But do you know, is anyone doing LHC studies with ultra-wide luminos directly to see what it...
No.
What
it's, from what I can tell from the literature and talking to my experimental colleagues, nobody has ever treated any SUSY particle off-shell or even imposed a bright vigor. To the best of my knowledge, the most that Pythia or Herwig has ever been modified to do is to impose a bright vigor line shape onto top quark pairs. Now, it would be a natural thing to extend that, but I think people simply haven't thought about how wide these guys are when they're up at a TeV or more. It's just sort of gotten forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're aware of someone having done this, then I'd like to know about it, because then...
Well, I'll look, but I don't think I've
seen it. I don't think anyone's done this. And I've talked to Peter Richardson about it, and this was completely new to him, so I know that Herwig doesn't include it.
So the other comment, I don't know if this is something that you would consider or if it would work, but could you perhaps make a web form interface where people could type in their model and you could do some sort of estimation of the size of this effect? I don't know. I mean, some of your equations are quite complicated, but some things are probably very simple to say, yes, this is a big problem. Red flag.
You kind of just have to try examples. I think it's going to be a problem for any case where you have a heavy colored object, because QCD interference will happen there. So there will be other diagrams that contribute, but...
Okay, so rules of thumb is enough, I guess.
Yeah, but I don't know that it can get much more rigorous than that, because there's a lot of different things going on at the same time. And maybe we'll get a better insight to it after a while.
One of the things, MudGrab is set up to calculate offshore.
Nobody uses it. Of course, that's what we did for this, was we used MadGraph. But, you know, nobody does SUSY studies with off-shell treatment like this. They still produce two things on shell and then let Pythia or whatever handle the decays and go on.
Yeah, when you say nobody, you mean no experimentalists.
Well, we're the first theorists to do this way.
Well,
that was precisely what we were going
for. Carlos for a year with all the off-shell effects. And so.
There are no studies... SUSY studies that I know of that treat it this way.
And the other thing is, have you tried using Gray SUSY? It does like all the graphics. It's like my graph, but it does the SUSY stuff.
SUSY Grace is untested, and I would not trust it at the moment. It's untested like SUSY COMPEP is untested, and I know SUSY COMPEP has bugs, so I don't trust anything that comes from those codes at the moment. You can find cases in COMPEP, actually, where it will not produce all the diagrams for you that you know should be there. And Gray simply hasn't been compared to anything else yet. So. The reason why I trust this is because there are three independent codes that actually work differently and that are tested to each other to multiple digit precision for, you know, hundreds of processes. We're really convinced that these codes work properly. So that's the only statement I'm going to make about them.
I can't quite remember, but are there cases, I think there are some cases, where both the incoming and the outgoing final particles are the same. I guess this is only an R parity violation in both the background and the signal. As long as you have R parity is conserved, you always have that neutralino that separates standard model backgrounds from, so there'd be no interference.
Oh, with the standard model part.
The standard model. But I think
if
you go to R parity violation, you can't.
You might have in that case, but you know, that's one step beyond what we're trying to do at the moment. Now there is one other thing that I didn't show you, which is if you want to consider, say, you have U left production and now treat the U left off shell, you get a lot more resonant diagrams where you have valence coming in going to the final state, which is essentially the first case, but you can double that with the other side being valence as well. And interferences there could get even worse. So I can easily construct cases that will give you more interference than the one I've shown you already. Bob.
So people are making the argument now, in fact I've made it too, that in order to do discovery at the LHC, the only thing we need is essentially narrow width. I mean, in particular, I'm talking about the Marmoset people who made this code. Would you agree with that statement?
I think that's a reasonable statement. because any one of these SUSY signatures that I showed you is going to give you events that look very different than the standard model for the most part. It's going to be multiple leptons, multiple very high PT jets, different kinematics that clearly have some other kind of resonance structure, but just very smeared out. Now, granted that the Alpjin people showed recently that the 4-jet plus missing energy background from standard model is bigger than you think it is, it didn't destroy the signal. It just means there's something else that you have to consider. I think discovery would still come, clearly.
So really, it comes down to parameters.
You start to measure masses and parameters, and the more you get into this, the more uncertain you are, and we have to simply see what these distributions look like. I mean, these bright Wigners that I showed you for the heavy squirt should alarm you, because they look very different than what the simulations assume right now. But you can also probably find scenarios where the jet and lepton edges will be pretty sharp compared to this. You know, the relative spectra doesn't do too much. There's not too much interference. There's no major accelerant effect. You can construct those cases, too.
So I suppose what you're saying is that if you ran Harvard set, you might get the wrong mass, but you would still get the discovery.
Probably, yeah. I don't think this impacts discovery very much at all. But what you interpret it to be once you discover some excess is going to really matter. It really will depend on this stuff.
So, last question. So I did some detailed investigating of how the TT bar is extracted, particularly the matrix element method they use. They do use the full correct matrix element, but they do separate the background from the signals. They use an XLR code for the background and then a full signal matrix element. There's no interference between signal and background.
Mm-hmm.
Did you claim that is? I convinced myself this was okay because gamma over n to the fourth is incredibly small.
I think it's a very reasonable thing to do because you're looking right at the pole where the background interference is electroweak versus QCD.
Yep.
In the cases I showed you, it was QCD and QCD. That can be much larger. So
well, there are two jets there.
It's partly electroweak, but you're still having to produce two Ws, depending on what the final state is that you're looking at. But
yeah.
In general, it's not as much of a worry. Nicholas Cower actually spent a lot of time looking at that for the LHC, where top is treated off-shell and there's various backgrounds. And unless you drive very far into the top off-shell region, there's not much interference with the other stuff. So I think it's quite reasonable to do that.
Okay.